Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and earned an MA in political science from Kansas State University. He served in the U.S. Army for 22 years and rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel. He was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, serving Florida's 22nd District. He is currently a contributor for Fox News and the author of Guardian of the Republic. One of the bravest and most articulate voices in conservative politics today, his name, Colonel Alan B. West. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Colonel Alan West, author of Guardian of the Republic. Colonel, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Yeah, I tell you what, Herman West Sr., who we affectionately would call Buck, and Elizabeth Thomas West, who was affectionately called Snooks, they set the course for me in my life, having two very strong, focused, and committed conservative parents who taught me the importance of faith and family and education and personal responsibility and service to our country. That started me out on the right path and got me to be the man that I am today.
Talking about setting the course regarding service to our country, that's a culture within the West family for generations.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. My father served in World War II. He was a logistics specialist in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. He was wounded while running dispatches there in the Po Valley in Italy. And incredibly enough, in 1984, that was my first tour of duty, was over in Vicenza, Italy, not far from, I guess, where my dad was wounded. Mom served 25 years or so with the 6th Marine Corps District Headquarters. She was a civilian employee there. My older brother was a Vietnam-era veteran, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, wounded at Khe Sanh. I served 22 years. I started wearing a uniform in 1976 as a high school sophomore in the high school junior ROTC program and went on for a successful 22-year career in the military. And now my brother's son, my nephew, Herman West III, we call him Bernie, was promoted to major this past January, and he is now about to start the Army Command and General Staff College, which is something that I went through back in 1996, and he is a paratrooper and an artillery officer following the footsteps of his uncle.
In January 2003, Colonel West, you got your orders for Iraq, and then in August of 2003, there was an incident. Can you tell us about that incident?
Well, you know, I don't, you know, really think, you know, big about it. I was surprised how big it became back here in the States. But I think a commander's responsibility is to look after the safety and the lives of his men in the combat zone, which is what my father and older brother taught me. And I wrote about that in the book. And they were combat veterans. So I used a psychological intimidation tactic to convince one of the detainees who we believed had information about attacks on our unit. And I fired a pistol across the back of his head into a weapons clearing barrel. And then I summarily reported myself to my commanding officer. The Army decided to conduct an investigation. It was an Article 32 hearing, and I was fined $5,000. But on my wall, there hangs an honorable discharge signed by the president. And I retired after 22 years with all rank benefits and privileges. So it was just me doing what I think a commander is supposed to do in a combat zone, making sure that the noses that get on the airplane to deploy are the exact same noses that come back for redeployment.
Can you tell us about our servicemen and servicewomen who defend our freedom today?
Well, I think you're talking about the best and brightest amongst us. You know, it's amazing when you look at the service academies, when you look at our recruitment and retention, it's still quite high. I mean, regardless of the, I guess, the misplaced priorities of this current Obama administration into social egalitarian policies and programs and trying to make the military more reflective of what they see as far as social justice. You know, you still have the men and women who want to serve on freedom's ramparts to make sure that we have not just a 238th Independence Day, but countless amounts of future Independence Days. And the threats out there are, without a doubt, even more vile and vicious than we have ever seen. But you still have those men and women that are willing to raise their right hand to say that they will support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that they will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That's what makes America exceptional.
In 2010, you ran for Congress, Florida's 22nd District. Why did you run for Congress?
Well, basically because someone challenged me, and they said just because you have hung up your camouflage uniform and your boots does not mean that your oath of service to the Constitution, to this great nation, has ended. There's no statute of limitations on that oath. And as a matter of fact, about, I'd say, 45 or so years ago, you know, 70 to 75% of the men and women who served up there on Capitol Hill had military experience, and I think it makes a big difference. This country once looked to the men and women of, you know, high honor, integrity, and character who had worn the uniform, who had been willing to, you know, give that last full measure of devotion to continue their service as public servants, you know, being at the federal government level, state, or local government. And so that was the challenge given to me, and I decided to accept that challenge after praying about it and speaking with the wife and daughters.
In January of 2011, you become the congressman for the 22nd District, the first African-American Republican congressman from Florida since Joshua Walls left office in 1876. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was incredible, you know, to think hopefully that Joshua T. Walls is looking down upon me and probably saying, why did it take you so long? But, you know, it was an impeccable honor to be able to continue that legacy that, you know, a former slave and Joshua T. Walls had established. And I think that we have to work hard in making sure that we remember that the first black members of the House and Senate were GOP. They were Republicans, and we cannot have those type of gaps ever again. But, you know, to have been brought up in the inner city of Atlanta, Georgia, you know, just a simple upbringing, same neighborhood as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and to then all of a sudden be the congressional representative that included, you know, Palm Beach, you know, the highest per capita income zip code in the United States of America. That, once again, is a testimony to the greatness of America that says no matter where you're born, no matter where you come from, you can achieve whatever level of success that you set your eyes upon and put out there as a goal and an objective.
We're talking to Colonel Ellen West, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Colonel Ellen West, one of the bravest and most articulate conservative leaders in America today. Colonel, your recent book, Garden of the Republic, what's the basic message?
Well, the basic message goes back to what Benjamin Franklin said during an exchange after the deliberations of the U.S. Constitution were over in September 1787. When he exited Independence Hall, he was met by a Philadelphia socialite by the name of Mrs. Powell. And Mrs. Powell asked him, well, doctor, what is it that we have, a republic or a monarchy? And Franklin, with his impeccable wit, replied, you have a republic if you can keep it. And I wrote that book because I really believe, you know, the challenge is for us in America to understand first and foremost what a republic is and then stand up and be a guardian of it and defend it and keep it, as Franklin challenged us, you know, some 217-odd years ago. So when I wrote that book, it was pretty much so a philosophical biography about the impact that my parents had upon me, the United States military, key leaders in the military. And then I talked about the foundational basis that the founding fathers looked at to establish this incredible country and this constitutional republic, and some of the opposing viewpoints and thoughts and perspectives that challenge us today. And then I also talk about what it means to be a black conservative. I mean, you were very kind calling me brave and articulate, but, you know, being a black conservative has always been out there. It's not something new. And I use Booker T. Washington, whose writings at the turn of the century really established those thought principles in the black community of education, entrepreneurship, and self-reliance. So I believe the more we talk about it, and the more we talk about it in simplistic terms to the American people, I believe that more people will see that, you know, the principles that have made this country great, the principles that make for strong families, the principles that build up our young men and women to be successful in their pursuits, all the founding principles of the fathers and conservative values. And we just need to remind people of that.
Talk to us about the French historian Alexis de Tocqueville.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, and we have a young man right now who just came out with a book, American Boomerang. His name is Nick Adams, and he's an Australian who toured the United States of America here recently. And he just wondered, what is it that makes America so great? And he asked me to write the foreword to his book, American Boomerang. Well, you go back to the 1830s, and you had a young Frenchman by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville who came here and did the exact same thing, because he was wondering, what is it about this American experiment in liberty, freedom, and democracy that makes it different from all the other countries in the world? And he got an essence, he got a sensing and a taste of that, and he wrote a book, Democracy in America, which I think is, you know, when I read Democracy in America and I read Nick Adams's book, American Boomerang, they serve as clarion calls for us to once again, you know, go back and reconnect and understand, you know, what it is about America, what it is about being that beacon, that shiny city that sits upon a hill, as Ronald Reagan described it, that draws people to come here. Now, I prefer them to come here legally, of course, but how do we get back to understanding that? How do we get back to having that pride within ourselves and not having this apologist type of manner about us? And that's why I think Alexis de Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America, is a great book for all Americans to read today.
Less than a week before the 2008 presidential election, then-candidate Barack Obama proclaimed, quote, "We are just 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America." In hindsight, Colonel West, what was he telling us?
Well, he was telling us exactly what he wanted to do. And, you know, as a military officer, I will tell you, there's nothing better than having an adversary or an opposition or an enemy that tells you what they want to do. It is then the onus is upon you to understand that and accept that reality. And that is, you know, really, I'm so glad you asked that question, because it leads back to, you know, why I wrote the book and why I have this stance and why I feel so strongly and passionately about my country, is because fundamentally we have something that is greater than any other country in the world. In 238 years, look at what we have achieved in America. It is absolutely astonishing. That is because we believe in a spirit of limited government. We believe in that fiscal responsibility, the sovereignty of the individual, a free market economy, and our strong national defense. But what Barack Obama said, you know, 5 days before that 2008 election, I'm going to change all that. I'm going to transform you from all of that. And when you look at that video, when he said that, and the crowd just starts cheering and screaming and clapping, that is the problem with America, because no one stopped and said, what are you talking about? What are we transforming to, but most importantly, what are we transforming from? So the problem in America is ourselves, the voting electorate. You know, it's not the politicians, because they're telling us exactly what they want to do, especially the progressive socialists. And we see those policies of Obama failing in every single aspect.
In his inaugural address in January of 2009, he said, quote, "We must begin the work of remaking America." In your book, I quote you now, you say, "We are moving from the pursuit of happiness to the guarantee of happiness." Please.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we should have and what Thomas Jefferson established was a government that respected the inalienable rights of the individual, which came from a creator. And those rights were life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so what I see happening is that we are moving away from understanding that those inalienable rights came from a creator to believe that they are granted and taken away from a government, by a government. And so when you don't have a pursuit of happiness, you have a guarantee of happiness. And it comes back to what de Tocqueville said, one of his quotes attributed to him, when he said that a democracy cannot last as a permanent form of government. It can only last until the point when the electorate realizes they can vote their own largesse from the public treasury. And from that moment on, they will always vote for the person that promises them the most benefits, with the ensuing result being the collapse of the democracy over loose fiscal policy, followed by a dictatorship. And I think that's where we are in America, because what do you hear happening? Everyone is promising a certain collective group, you know, you're going to get this, you're going to get that. And in the end, that's not what this is about. It's not about a government, man, trying to guarantee happiness. It is about a government structure that is placed there by the consent of the governed to develop the policies by which people can have a pursuit of happiness. But all we're doing now is a form of political bribery that in the pamphlet The Law by Frederick Bastiat, he said this is, I mean, it is really, you know, criminal in aspect. It's misperceived benevolence, and, you know, that's what is occurring. You know, a bribery promising people anything they want from the public treasury, and then saying that this group is going to be responsible for making sure that you get those things that, that guarantee your happiness.
We're talking to Colonel Alan West. Colonel, so many of the other parts of the world are enthusiastically embracing capitalism, while at the same time, many of us are attacking and trying to kill capitalism. Why?
Well, I think, again, you see a desire in America to move away from that fundamental thing, a free market economy, that says that we reward the individual for their investment, for their ingenuity, for their innovation. That is what has made America successful in 238 years. But instead, we're trying to replace it with a government-driven type of economy. Look at what is going on in the with the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Everyone's cheering this record 17,000 points that it reached. But if we weren't doing this thing called quantitative easing, which is basically just printing money and keeping interest rates artificially low to try to prop up an economy that is struggling under the failing policies of this administration, you would probably see this economy tank. But we're creating a bubble out there. Instead of going down and saying we want to have the tax and regulatory policies and monetary policies that enable small businesses, which are about 75 to 80% of the economy of the United States of America, to be able to grow, we've got to open up these closed storefronts. We've got to get more Americans back to work and get Americans off of the largesse, the dole, if you want to call it that, of the federal government. So what you're really seeing happening is that we're moving away from that free market economy that rewards the American people who are going out and working hard and being able to enjoy the fruits of their labor to an American electorate where they sit back and they wait to get a check from the federal government, which is just a form of economic enslavement.
When we come back, we'll ask Colonel West about progressive socialism. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Colonel Alan West and two quotes in his book, first from Churchill. Socialism is a philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance, the gospel of envy. Its inherent virtue is the equal sharing of misery. Second, Baroness Margaret Thatcher. The problem with socialism is that you eventually run out of other people's money. Colonel, what's progressive socialism all about?
Well, first of all, you know, I always ask people when they say they're a liberal, I say, are you a classical liberal or a postmodern liberal? There's a big distinction. I mean, when you look at someone like John Locke, who is the father of, you know, classical liberalism, it is about promoting the individual, their liberty, their freedom, their ability to acquire property, because Locke wrote about life, liberty, and property. Jefferson called it life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the unalienable rights. So what I see this thing that has morphed into the United States of America, this progressivism that really took root in America at the turn of the century, which is just a different strain of a communist type of perspective, you know, big government control, more government-directed type of economic theory and policies, kind of like the John Maynard Keynes, you know, theory of economics. And then when you look at it and combine it with this socialism where you have the belief in nationalizing production of a country. When you look at the creation and expansion of a welfare nanny state, this belief in a social utopianism based upon, you know, they perceive social justice, and then a secular type of state. That's where we're moving to in America. We're moving to a bigger government control into every aspect of our lives. And the quote from Winston Churchill is so appropriate. Because what we see is not the preeminence of the individual, but the promotion of the collective. And we try to get collective groups pitted against each other. We try to create envy, you know, the 1% against the 99%. Who would have ever thought that that would be a campaign theme in the United States of America? You hear about war on women. No one has a war on women, but you hear about that here in the United States of America. The you know, everything is racist. To have a picture ID to go vote is racist. When think about where can you go in the United States of America and not have to present a picture ID? You can't get on an airline. Is that racist? So all of that politics of envy, all of this politics of the government providing you more. You know, and you are not responsible for your own lives. That's what I mean by progressive socialism. And this is something that we have to openly discuss in the United States of America, because it's not so much about parties. It's about principles, and it's about government theories that we have to understand.
America was established, formed on the Judeo-Christian fundamentals and religious freedom. And a lot of people believe religious freedom is under attack. Talk about that, please.
Well, I think you just have to look at the recent case with Hobby Lobby, where here you have a federal government, not through a legislative process of Obamacare, but it was just a rule, a mandate that was developed in the HHS, Health and Human Services Agency, you know, by Kathleen Sebelius, that basically said that, you know, your religious beliefs as a person, and if you are a person that has a corporation or business or a company, it's not important. What we want to do supersedes it. So you don't have freedom of religion and the free exercise thereof. We're trying to free everyone of their religious beliefs. And so thank God that you have a very common sense Supreme Court that said that mandate, that rule developed by the administration, like I said, through regulatory order and fiat, was struck down, because there are companies that have closely held companies that have their beliefs. And we're talking about companies that are, you know, owned by, you know, a family. So that's very important, that we don't separate ourselves from our Judeo-Christian faith heritage. Notice I didn't say religion, but a faith heritage. And slowly but surely, that's what progressive socialists are trying to define separation of church and state as. Because the original intent of Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote the letter to the Danbury Baptist Convention about separation of church and state, is that we don't have a head of church that is also the head of state, and we don't have an established religion. That's very clearly articulated in our founding documents.
Another quote from the book, Robert Hutchins: "The death of democracy is not likely to be an assassination by ambush. It will be a slow extinction from apathy, indifference, and undernourishment." Many people today, Colonel West, are depressed, angry, frightful, in that we seemingly are powerless to stop this fundamental transformation that we're watching. What can we do?
Well, I think first and foremost, you have to remember that this is a constitutional representative republic, and you are able to pick and choose who you want to go back as your representative up in Washington, D.C. You look at what happened in the Virginia Congressional District number 7. Where David Brat upset the sitting House Majority Leader, first time ever in the history of this country, in a primary. So the American people need to rise up, educate themselves first and foremost, because what politicians thrive upon is a uninformed electorate, the low to no information voter that they can easily manipulate, especially when you look at the liberal progressive media that is out there, you know, opining away and putting out falsehoods and misleading the American people. So I think it is incumbent upon, you know, our country to educate itself. Now, there's always going to be a 35 to 40% that is very happy with, you know, a big government approach. But that's not the American way. And we need to make that clear delineation like Ronald Reagan did when he ran against Jimmy Carter. And look at the overwhelming success he had in that election of winning 49 out of 50 states. I mean, that's clearly, you know, what he talked about, no more pretty pastels but bold colors. That's what we have to be able to do to show the American people, you know, the difference between a conservative policy agenda and philosophy of governance and where it comes from, as opposed to this fundamental transformation and this progressive socialist perspective.
Anybody that questions or stands up against or says anything against this administration or the Senate, what comes back is they're political and they're racist. How can we defend ourselves from those charges?
Well, the first thing you said is what you said is the whole point. You don't need to defend yourself. You're standing on principle, and you're talking about policies. You're talking about a very dangerous agenda. So if the other side wants to call you a racist, and look, it's very hard to call me a racist, so I think I have a little cover. But when the other side calls you that, you don't need to defend yourself. As a matter of fact, you should not react to it because it becomes very Pavlovian. As long as, and I'll be very honest with this, as long as white America continues to react to being called a racist, then the leftists, the progressive socialists and their media accomplices will continue to use that against you because they know they get a reaction, and the reaction is that you self-censor. So you need to back away from that and stop defending yourself and say, hey, whatever you say, because what's going to happen next is, and I write about in the book, the next gimmick candidate will be the first woman, because if you don't agree with the progressive socialist woman that they choose, then you're going to be a sexist and a misogynist. Then it's going to be a Hispanic, because if you don't agree there, you're a xenophobe. Then it's going to be the first gay president, because if you don't agree with that, then you're a homophobe. And so we have to stop reacting to these labels and these name-calling tactics that the left uses, which is rooted in the Saul Alinsky, Rules for Radicals book, which is so important for people to read. And then understand this. Saul Alinsky is from Chicago. Barack Obama is from Chicago. Hillary Clinton, Chicago. Rahm Emanuel, Chicago. David Axelrod, Chicago. Bill Ayer, Chicago. Louis Farrakhan, Jesse Jackson, Sr., David Plouffe, Valerie Jarrett, Tony Rezko. Something is not going well in Chicago, and we have to recognize that this is a cradle of progressive socialist thought, and we need to identify that, but most importantly, stop reacting to it and stop trying to defend ourselves, go on the offense.
You have great courage, and a lot of people are just afraid today. How does one get courage?
Courage, and look, I've been in combat zones, and courage is the admission that you do have fears, but you don't take counsel of it. And I will refuse to take counsel of my fears. You know, just the same as when I was a paratrooper jumping out of airplanes. You know, I respect the fact that I could get hurt, but I did not fear jumping from the airplane. I just made sure that, you know, I did all the things that I was trained to do. So the same thing here. If, you know, fear paralyzes you, then that's exactly what your opposition wants, because then you are afraid to make any type of counter decisions. You're afraid to take any type of actions. And once again, as we just talked about, all you do is sit back and try to defend yourself. You've got to be on the offense. You have to be aggressive. That is what the left, which is really a minority, but they just have a louder voice. And we have to not take counsel of the fears, take counsel of when they start yelling and screaming and their typical reaction. We just got to continue to press on. So for me, it is very simple what courage is. My father, my mother, they all taught me about courage. And, you know, when I read my Bible, my favorite verse is in Joshua chapter 1, verses 5 through 9, especially verse 9, where it says, "Be strong and of good courage, for the Lord thy God shall never leave you nor forsake you." So I don't worry about what people say or do. As long as I know I'm speaking the truth, I'm good to go.
Speaking of courage, when we come back, we'll ask Colonel West about one of his heroes, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Pasula, and we're with Colonel Ellen West, one of your heroes, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Tell us about him.
Oh, I mean, if we don't know the story of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain in America, then we are really creating a disservice to ourselves and to our children, to our grandchildren. He was a man who was not a professional soldier. He was a professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin College up in Maine. But yet he volunteered to go and serve because he believed in the cause of liberty and freedom and the preservation of the Union. And what Joshua Chamberlain first was exposed to was the horrific battle at Fredericksburg when the Confederates had Mary's Heights, and they just rained down a hail of musket fire and cannon fire on the Union forces, and of course they won the day. But Chamberlain is a part of he was commander of the 20th Maine and a part of the Army of the Potomac. They began their trek north as Lee had crossed over behind the Blue Ridge, and he was operating up in Pennsylvania. And those two forces came together at a place called Gettysburg back in July of 1863, from the 1st through the 3rd. But it was on the second day at Gettysburg when Chamberlain was told to take his position at the end of the Union line there along Cemetery Ridge at a place called Little Round Top. And he was the end. And his orders were that you cannot retreat, you cannot surrender, because if you do, the entire Army of the Potomac will be rolled up, surrounded, and captured. So he understood the gravity of the situation. As he looked down Little Round Top, he saw General John Bell Hood's Texans and Alabamians, you know, making their way through Devil's Den. They were successful in getting the Union forces out of Devil's Den, and then they turned their sights toward Little Round Top. And on that hot July the 2nd day, casualties mounting, he ran out of ammunition, and this simple professor of rhetoric from Bowdoin College, Maine, ordered something that had not been heard in the Union Army to that point. He ordered a bayonet charge, and he saved the day on day two of Gettysburg. He saved the Army of the Potomac, which ended up leading to the first defeat of Robert E. Lee in the Civil War, his Army of Northern Virginia. But more importantly, it probably saved the Union, because if Lee had been successful at Gettysburg, his intent was to march on Washington, D.C. from the north and demand a peace settlement with Abraham Lincoln, because he would have destroyed the only army that stood in the way between himself and Washington, D.C. That's why Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain is such a hero of mine. He stood as the honor guard for the surrender of Lee at Appomattox. He went back and became a governor of the state of Maine. It's a great story.
And he was awarded the Medal of Honor for that
day. And was awarded the Medal of Honor.
75 years ago, Colonel West, family and education were very important values in our black community. What happened, and most importantly, how do we reestablish these family and education values in our black community?
Well, I think it goes back to something we were talking about earlier, when the government comes in and provides, you know, largesse from the public treasury. One of the major failures of the Great Society program, and I wrote about it in the book, was the decimation of the black family, because Lyndon Johnson came up with this brilliant idea of providing a check to women who have children out of wedlock, and the check keeps coming as long as you keep a man or father out of the house. So what happened was that the government came into the black community and destroyed the family by replacing the man in the home, the father in the home, and the responsibility that a man has. You know, you had a black community that when I grew up, you saw mothers and fathers in homes. Now today, after 50 years of, you know, Johnson's policy that has continued to be perpetuated, 28% of black children have mothers and fathers in the home. Only 28%. To me, it's genocidal, you know, what the progressive socialists have done to the black community. You can see it in our inner cities. You can see it in Detroit. You can see it in Chicago. You can see it in my old neighborhood in Atlanta. And, you know, with that comes the breakdown of education, because of the responsibilities of having two very strong parents that got you focused as a young person is lost. Not saying that single parents can't do it, But in the inner city environment, we have created such a deplorable situation. Look at what just happened recently on Independence Day weekend in Chicago. Nine deaths and 60, wounded because of shootings. That was not part of the inner city that I grew up in. My parents stressed education. That was the great equalizer. That opened the doors to the equality of opportunity that this country affords. But what we're doing is we're making more people that are subservient and becoming, you know, enslaved to the government as they sit back in Section 8 housing and they wait for the check to come to them. That is not what our black community was built upon. Our black community was built upon what Booker T. Washington talked about, education, entrepreneurship, and self-reliance. That has been destroyed.
Our foreign policy, lead from behind, apologize, toothless threats, has resulted in our friends don't trust us and our enemies don't fear us. What's the answer?
The answer is for America to get a Reagan-esque type of leader that understands that it is about peace through strength. When Ronald Reagan stood at the Brandenburg Gates and told Mr. Gorbachev to tear down this wall, when he looked at the Soviet Union and declared it an evil empire, that rallied the world and that rallied freedom in Eastern Europe. And so what do we have today? We have a president that goes around to the Turkish General Assembly or gives a speech at Cairo University that basically says, you know, America will not stand up against the Islamic totalitarians. When we are releasing five senior members of the Taliban back to the Taliban at a time when the Taliban is still fighting us, that's aiding and abetting. That's providing material support and comfort to the enemy. That's not leading. And so we see the instances, like you said, Jack, of our allies being confused and our enemies being emboldened. Look at this Islamic State that has established itself in Syria and Iraq and is continuing to be on the move when the president ran around telling us all that Al-Qaeda is decimated, they have no leadership, and look what just happened. And this is not something new. They took over Fallujah and Al-Ramadi back in January, February of this year, and we paid no attention to it. Look at what China's doing. Look at what Russia has done with their expansion into Ukraine and taking over the Crimean Peninsula, you know, a violation of a sovereign state. It's about peace through strength, and the American people have to not want to have a cool, pop culture type of leader who really isn't a leader at all. It's more of a usurper and a petty charlatan is what we have is for the United States. Ronald Reagan gave us a great model, and I believe this country will produce another one.
Colonel Alan West, thank you. We admire you for standing up for what you believe. Please keep it up.
And I will. And for the young people, I will tell them that it is so important that we preserve the American dream for them, because the greatness of America is that we always pass down something better to our subsequent generations than that was left for us.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.